It's Monday, November 15, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. They are the engagement ring of the 21st century. Ed Weiner, a family law specialist with a law firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, was speaking there of a prenuptial agreement. In an article that ran over the weekend by Jeff Strickler, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, these attorneys are pointing out that prenuptial agreements, or prenups, are now becoming standard fare in marriages. Now, they used to be something of an eccentricity, something that was reserved for people of extraordinary means who had extraordinarily little confidence in their upcoming marriage. But now they're becoming more and more standard fare for young couples and older couples getting married. As this news report indicates, the prenup's becoming more and more a part of the wedding planning. More women are bringing assets into the marriage, said Sherman Locke, an attorney with another law firm in Minneapolis. In a recent survey, 73% of attorneys cited an increase in prenup agreements during the past 5 years. That's according to the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. In addition, 52% of the respondents said more women are seeking the agreements. So it turns out that two particular developments are appearing on the scene with prenups. Number one, more couples of average means are asking them, and more women are taking the initiative to have them a part of the wedding planning. This is something of a new development related to marriage, and it tells us a great deal about what's going on. I mean, after all, you don't enter into a prenuptial agreement unless you have a significant concern that the marriage isn't going to last. As Mr. Strickler says, the fact that many of these unions are second marriages or beyond is a major factor in the prenup boom. Having been through the emotional and financial cost of a contested divorce, people want to make sure they don't have to go through it again. Jeff Hicken, who is president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Association of Matrimonial Lawyers, said the prenups are not just for second marriages, but increasingly for first marriages. He attributes much of this to the delay of marriage. As people are getting older, they have more assets than they may have had in the past, and perhaps a little less idealism as well. Now, by the way, one of the facts that's thrown out here is that couples earning as little as $40,000 a year are now arranging for prenups. And from a financial standpoint, some of these lawyers are arguing that the prenup is even more necessary for low-income couples than for high-income couples. Something tells me that's going to be a hard argument to make. But if there is indeed a 70-plus percent increase in prenuptial agreement business over the last 5 years amongst these lawyers, well, something's going on. What's going on here can't be divorced from the larger context of what's happened to marriage. Marriage has undergone massive transformations over the last 4 to 5 decades, none more crucial than the transformation that was made possible by no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce changed marriage in ways that were not perceived at the time. In fact, one of the effects was the fact that it marginalized fathers. But before we even go there for another conversation, it's important to recognize that no-fault marriage meant that divorce could happen at virtually any time for any reason or no reason when called for by just one member of the marriage, one party, husband or wife. And for that reason, the prenuptial agreement becomes something of a financial defense. It originated from wealthy individuals marrying less wealthy individuals who did not want to put their capital at risk. But now it appears that the risk is being shared by a far larger pool. The great damage to this, however, is not to anyone's financial standing. It's to the institution of marriage. Christians looking at this have to understand that to enter into a prenuptial agreement is to enter into marriage planning for its dissolution. That's inconceivable, I think, from a standpoint of Christian faithfulness, but there will be no shortage of lawyers to suggest that it just might be advisable. This is a case in which Christians better understand the difference between faithfulness and what the world would consider prudence. Occasionally, when reviewing the news, you come across a flurry of news stories that are quite unexpected, but you can track them back to a source and understand that something happened so out of the ordinary that virtually every major newspaper and news organization felt that it had to say something about the story. This was the case with a conference that was held just a few days ago by the Roman Catholic hierarchy over the issue of exorcism. As Rachel Zoll, the Associated Press, reports, the Roman Catholic bishops held a conference on how to conduct exorcisms. The 2-day training, which was to end just this past Saturday in Baltimore, is to outline the scriptural basis of evil, instruct clergy on evaluating whether a person is truly possessed, and review the prayers and rituals that comprise an exorcism. Now, the issue here is somewhat just that of numbers. There is more call for exorcism than at present. There are priests who are qualified by the Roman Catholic Church to perform the rite. Lori Goodstein, writing in the New York Times, which offered a very lengthy article on the subject, quoted Bishop Thomas Paprocki of Springfield, Illinois, who said, "Not everyone who thinks they need an exorcism actually does need one. It's only used in those cases where the devil is involved in an extraordinary sort of way in terms of actually being in possession of the person. But it's rare. It's extraordinary. So the use of exorcism is also rare and extraordinary, but we have to be prepared." End quote. Well, being prepared in this case means attempting to prepare something like several hundred priests to be able to conduct the rite of exorcism. We need to stand back and look for a moment. There is no doubt that demon possession is a very real threat. You read the New Testament and you come across not only one, but repeated accounts of demon possession that required an exorcism. Jesus himself exorcised demons from some individuals, and later his disciples did the same. There is absolutely no warrant for believing that this is simply something that is mythological or ancient and rooted only in the past. No, the Bible underlines and affirms the reality of the devil and the demons. But what's wrong, then, with the rite of exorcism? Should evangelicals also have something as a parallel rite that we have as a part of our worship and church ministry? The answer to that is no. And the reason for that is that the mechanism for exorcising a demon is the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is no particular incantation or rite. There is no particular priestly ministry that will be efficacious here. There's another major misunderstanding that marks the difference between the way evangelicals and Roman Catholics look at the issue of demons. Evangelicals, who are instructed by the gospel, come to understand in the New Testament that there is absolutely no way that one who has been united with Christ can then be possessed by a demon. Can Satan and demons do damage to Christians? Can Christians be tempted and led astray and confused? Yes, but possessed? Absolutely not. In the New Testament, those who are possessed by demons have not yet experienced the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the antidote, the exorcism mechanism for getting rid of demons and demonic possession, well, that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. When we share the gospel of Jesus Christ, when the gospel of Jesus Christ is preached and taught, when in evangelism and missions the gospel is taken, well, that leads to the pushing back of the forces of evil. As the Apostle Paul tells us at the conclusion to his letter to the Ephesians, we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, even the rulers of the spirits of the air. These are very real dangers. But no Christian is in danger of being possessed by a demon, and no church needs a rite of exorcism. What we do is confidently live as Christians by the grace and mercy of the Lord Jesus Christ as we are united with Him and indwelt by the Spirit of Christ, and then we preach and teach the gospel. That's what the devil and the demons fear most. Sometimes it takes a little distance from an event like an election to take stock of what actually happened. Let's go back, for example, to California's vote in the midterm election just a few days ago. Proposition 19, which would have legalized the possession and sale of up to an ounce of marijuana, was defeated. Most of us walked away from that result believing that the grown-ups had finally shown up in California, and even that state, which is probably the most leftward when it comes to the drug culture and marijuana, had turned back an initiative to legalize marijuana. But that closer look is in order. Here's one thing we discover in that closer look. More people voted for the legalization of marijuana than voted for Meg Whitman, the Republican nominee for governor. In other words, the vote was a bit closer than initial media reports might have indicated. Now, those who were behind this effort, the backers of Proposition 19, felt that it was a victory of sorts that was disguised as a loss. As Jesse McKinley reports in the New York Times, these backers of legal marijuana found a silver lining in the results of the election. They say that the strong support that was indicated there means that the legalization of marijuana is virtually inevitable. Aaron Houston, who is the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy in Washington, D.C., said this, "We're going to win, and we're going to win a whole lot sooner than anyone thinks." Now, one of the things that would be behind this argument and would give these backers of legalized marijuana some confidence is that, well, a closer look at the results shows us something else, and that is that a breakdown by age of the electorate on this issue is spectacular. The young tended overwhelmingly to vote in favor of legalizing marijuana, and older citizens, especially senior adults, voted overwhelmingly not to. Now, there are a lot of issues going on here. As one observer pointed out, if you go back to 1979, forces that were pushing for the legalization of marijuana even back then were confident that they were just on the precipice of the victory for their cause. But it didn't happen. As someone else in this article points out, it's one thing to say you are for the legalization of marijuana. It's another thing to actually enter into the voting booth and vote positively and affirmatively for a proposal that says this is how it's going to happen, and then take responsibility for that vote and for that action. You know, I don't know what the tea leaves are, so to speak, on the issue of marijuana, but I do know that the kind of data that is giving encouragement to these backers of Proposition 19 in California should give us all pause. Sometimes we feel assured when we look at certain statistics or electoral results, survey data, or poll contents, and we feel that we are looking at a picture. But let's remember that there are minds in motion, and demographics play a very crucial role. The population isn't tomorrow what it is today, and when issues are age-specific, as this one is, and when the spectrum of disagreement over the age cohorts is remarkable, as we see here, well, there's every indication that the young have the momentum. And perhaps that silver lining that the backers of Proposition 19 found in the election should actually give them the confidence that they feel. We'll be watching this one with you. Finally, the news came over the weekend of the death of Henryk Gorecki. Gorecki was a Polish composer who died at age 76. His most famous work was his third symphony, known as the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. It was written after Mr. Gorecki came across the fact that a young girl had written a 15th century sacred lamentation on the wall of a Gestapo prison in southern Poland. He set it to music with full orchestration and a soprano solo, and the mournful music of his third symphony, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, became one of the iconic pieces of music of the 20th century. I don't know how many times I've listened to it. I listened to it over and over again. And if you ever wonder about the power of music to evoke lamentation and grief, well, Henryk Gorecki's Third Symphony will settle the issue. The best recording, by the way, is the recording done by the London Sinfonietta with soloist Don Upshaw. And by the way, that recording sold over 1 million copies, which for classical music makes it an absolute blockbuster. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Speaking of music, I want you to know about a very special Christmas concert to be held in Alumni Memorial Chapel at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary on December 9. We'll be led in music by Keith and Christian Getty, two of the most gifted Christian composers and hymnists in the world today. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.